Iraj Abedian is about the perfect guy to interview when you're talking of thought leadership information. Let me just explain what I mean by that. He spent 20 years, or almost 20 years, as a professor of economics at UCT, and he's had 20 years of running his own business, Pan-African Capital. In between, he was very popular or very well known in South Africa as the chief economist of Standard Bank. And the subject we're talking about today, well, there are not too many people in South Africa who know it as well as Iraj does, who was born and grew up in Iran. Iraj, I know you've got lots of fans in the BizNews community and elsewhere. Just to, before we kick off on the whole subject of Iran, which is South Africa's newest ally and Donald Trump's number one hated enemy, and I guess the implications that has for our poor country, your background in Iran, did you grow up in Tehran or where in the country?
Thank you very much, Alex, for the invitation, and I appreciate the chat. I was born in a village, not that different from some of our own rural villages when there is no water, sanitation, electricity. It's a rural subsistence agriculture where my father made a living. It's about what in Iran's language is central, north central part of Iran, 190 kilometers southeast of Tehran, but certainly not in Tehran.
Okay, so you're from the sticks, in other words, from the backwoods, as it might be. And how does a boy from the backwoods get to become a professor at UCT?
Look, I think it's thanks to my parents, primarily my father, especially, who was himself uneducated, illiterate, literally taught himself basic reading and writing, but incredibly worldwide, world thinking in terms of his belief and his own continuous search for education, regarding education as the most fundamental parental duty for boys and girls. So he literally, Alec, invested everything that he had emotionally, financially, and human energy in keeping us educated. And that's where I went to local school in the village, only 6 years, or primary school. Then he sent me on my own at the age of 11 to have a little room in somebody's backyard. In the closest city or town was those days, which had a high school. So I then worked 6 years there. After that, I got the message that I need to concentrate on education, and did well at high school and went to the University of Tehran to study economics and build myself up. Being from a poor family, I had to study and work after hours until 10 o'clock at night, every night, to just make it happen. And then after my education, and during the last year of my studies at University of Tehran, I joined an organization called ISEC. I don't know if you know ISEC. It's still very common in those days. Yeah, absolutely. Student exchange. So I got inspired by the concept of going to different cultures, different places, and the short of a long story, found myself at the National Committee of ISEC in Iran, and became part of the student exchange program, facilitating exchange of students from different parts of the world to Iran and from Iran to other countries. A 6-7 week stint in Finland. Now, you couldn't get more divergent from a social and geographic location or weather, everything else, from a Middle East village to the northern pole next to Helsinki. And so I built myself in line with my own, urges and my father's role model in keeping. To see the world as my home, not a village or any particular country. In the process, I also intellectually, spiritually bought myself, did a lot of search, and remain up to today a student of learning and a student of different cultures, societies, economies, and history.
I'm going to come back to Finland in a moment because it's in the news a lot at the given the aggression that we're seeing from Russia into Europe, and Finland's right at the border. And there's some very interesting thoughts on that. And having lived there, I'm sure you'll give us some insights too. But then arriving here in South Africa, what brought you to this country?
A mix of coincidences and luck and everything else. And as I mentioned, when I was studying, I had to work. And when I graduated, I had to work more. I had three jobs, Alec, after my graduation in 1977. And one of them, because of my ISEC connections, I ended up as a research analyst in the trade commercial attaches office of the South African Consul General at that time. And I was working in other places. So I started as a researcher producing reports on the economy of South Africa and the trade opportunities. And of course, the relationship at that time between South Africa and the Iranian government led by the Shah was quite warm and emotional. By that, I mean, during the Second World War, the father of the Shah was banished by the British or by the Allied forces to Johannesburg. So he died in Johannesburg. So the Shah had very soft spot for South Africa, and there was a general that during the Second World War, General Fraser, who was assigned to taking care of the Shah's father. So General Fraser at that time was the General Council of South Africa in Tehran, basically the top political attaches or emissary, who had taken care of the Shah when the Shah was a teenager, and when his father was banished under guard by the Allied forces. So that experience in the commercial attaché's office exposed me to South Africa and made South African friends with the commercial and technical team at the commercial attaché's office. And when the revolution happened in Iran in 1979, I had already worked three places and got admission from MIT and Stanford University, my two top sort of desired universities to go and study, and had paid my admission and was building my reserves to be able to afford to go there. When the revolution happened, 79, soon after that, or within 8 to 9 months of it, the American hostages happened. So now I've got a dilemma. I couldn't go to the United States because anybody from Iran was a terrorist and had to deserve to be terrorized. So I knew U.S. wasn't my destination, so I quickly shifted tack, got admission from London School of Economics. That was my second destination choice. And then when I went to resign, my boss at that time, John Sunday, who was a very seasoned South African political head at that time, told me, well, if you want to go, why don't you go to South Africa? And I took a deep breath, saying, from the frying pan into the fire. That was not my plans. I went home and I discussed it with my sister, and she said, look, you've got to go. Just by way of background, Alec, at that time, prior to that, 3 years prior to that, I had chosen to become a member of the Baha'i faith, which was fundamentally and is fundamentally a worldwide belief about the unification of humankind and seeing the world as one country, mankind as its citizens. So my sister says, well, if that's what your belief is, South Africa is the perfect place to go and live, work and learn, and at the same time live your principles of unity of humankind because of the racial apartheid in South Africa. So a combination of factors, revolution in Iran, my accidental work at the commercial attaché's office, the American hostages, my running out of options, so to speak. I had either to go to London or somewhere else, and my boss said, go to Cape Town. So I ended up in Cape Town as a student in January 1980. And the rest is history, as they say.
It's so interesting to me for you to have unpacked that for us, Iraj, and thank you for doing that, because it reminds me a bit of R.W. Johnson, and he was also during apartheid. He went the other way. He was a Rhodes Scholar, went to Oxford University, and he could get into Oxford University, which very few South Africans can. And there are very few people in the world who can get into MIT. So from your perspective, had you gone to MIT, I doubt we would have seen you ever again in this country, and perhaps even London School of Economics. It was a massive detour, because once you're on that track, it's almost like you're in a stratosphere around the world. Whereas here you came because of your faith, because the big boss decided that this is what you needed to do, I hope. And here you landed in South Africa. Academia, though, for a guy who had three jobs at one time, as you were explaining, what was it that drew you to a life for nearly two decades, which is very different to what you've done subsequent and before as an entrepreneur?
Alec, the reality is that when I was at UCT, I was inspired by the debate, by the political challenges, by the type of academics that we had from the right, left, and all shades in between. So the robust engagements, the level of research and so on, got me excited about learning more. So at that time in the early 80s, I saw from where I came from, which was a very narrow, closed environment in a village and in the Iranian government, Iranian society in general, suddenly I saw exposure to academics from UK, from US, from Germany, and a couple of, at that time, Eastern European academics who were involved and or visiting UCT. So that exposure, I guess, ignited, if that's the right term, my desire for research and learning. And I've always been a good disciplined student, and I remain so, and I see myself in that way. So when the opportunity came up, I haven't expressed this before so clearly, but let me let you into my inner self at that time. It's back in 1981, the depths, the darkest possibly days of apartheid in South Africa. And yet I was at UCT, although it was known as Kremlin on the hill because of the leftist orientation. The fact was that Cape Town was not an African city at that time. Actually, very few Africans there. And yet I had come to learn about African culture, and I couldn't find many, if any, around me. So I ended up at that time, from January 1981, I took a very, very junior entry-level academic position at the University of Transkei. And to me, that was where I was keen to learn African culture, African economy, and just broaden my own understanding. So to everybody's kind of surprise and poo-pooing, they said, why are you going to Transkei? And of course, all my fellow students, they thought, they hadn't, quite frankly, although they had been born and bred in Cape Town or in South Africa, they hadn't been to the rural Africa. And for me, that was the more exciting part. So I ended up in Transkei, or those days an independent state, and I thought the best way for me to learn how this economy works and what apartheid on the cutting edge means for people is if I take my master's dissertation on the quantification of a subsistence economy. Remember, Transkei was an independent national state, so you could talk about a national subsistence economy, one of the very few, in fact, globally. So I focused on that, on the supervision of a very distinguished Professor Wilson, Francis Wilson, who guided me very, very competently and befriended me, quite frankly, like most good supervisors do. So that then took me from Cape Town, which was Eurocentric by all accounts, an urban environment, to a deep rural area that was very similar to my own birthplace, to my own father's lived reality. So I did a lot of my research on the horseback because you couldn't drive beyond a certain point. So weekends I had to, a number of weekends I had to not only do my empirical research on horseback or on foot, but to sleep at the kraal with whoever allowed me to sleep and befriend the local headman and so on and so forth and explain what I was doing. And of course, be guided by my supervisors and my friends at the University of Transcar. So that was very exciting for me. That was as vastly different to Cape Town and the Eurocentric, if you like, developed economy of South Africa, as opposed to the underdeveloped subsistence part. So that was my first exposure also, Alec, to the dynamics of political, socio-political complexity of South Africa, to see there were people who daytime, so to speak, were a particular persona, and nighttime they had another persona from a political belief, modes of expression. When they didn't trust you, they were a different person, and when you befriended them, they had other orientation ideologically, and some of them were, not just some, the majority of those who were at the University of Transkei at those times were really exiled anti-apartheid activists, both white and black, both capitalist, communist, socialist, in between. And then I was exposed to a very fascinating, small but hyperactive intellectuals across the racial groupings who were exiled, and they were active, and they were belonging to different ideological schools, yet they had one common enemy, and that was apartheid. And I also was just a student. I wanted to learn about all of, for me, if you're a communist, I wanted to know what your views are. If you're a Pan-Africanist, I wanted to know what your views are. So I got myself into a very honest student style of sitting at their feet, so to speak, and listening intensively, including some of the intellectuals of pro-apartheid ideologues, like Professor Bashoff and them, who were equally passionate about apartheid and apartheid ideology. And I was just a student. I was absorbing like a sponge all of this. In the meantime, as an economist thinking about what does it mean for future of South Africa, what does it mean for the sustainability of socioeconomic balance, not from a political or security point of view, but purely from an economic point of view. So that was my biggest school of life in Transkei for a few years, being in the vortex of this political wrestling of these ideologies, at the same time keep making notes and keep thinking and researching about what are some of the policy options that may emerge. And of course, as you would know only too well, that was also a time that the so-called bipolar global geopolitics was falling apart. The USSR was under attack and just imploding from inside. President Reagan appealing to Gorbachev, break down that wall. And that, without a doubt, has ramification for South Africa's geopolitical locations, with the Russians on the west, with Americans hyperactive, trying to find ways and means of breaking down the wall. And that's also brought for me as an economist the era of the beginning of globalization, the beginning of opening of the borders, integration, and the reality of global financial market and global economic system becoming more and more interdependent and 24/7, 365 markets that are active. So all of these were happening at the same time. And I had fun. I had fun learning and trying to select the trajectory of my life.
It's a very good background for leapfrogging now, 40 years into where we are today. And the place that we're sitting at today is really interesting for all of South Africa. South Africa's a member of BRICS. South Africa brought Iran into BRICS. Iran is not friendly with this hyper-aggressive transactional new president of the United States. So where does it put us? Where is perhaps the place to start there is just describe to us the Iran as it is today. Would you, for instance, go back and live there? Would it be a country that would welcome you if you were to return?
Look, it's an interesting, ironic twist of history. Iran at the moment, today, is an apartheid country, possibly a little bit worse than South Africa in 1980 when I came this side. And the apartheid is not racial in Iran. Apartheid is ideological, religious, and gender, and a whole lot of other lines, unfortunately. The modus operandi of the Iranian regime is far more severe, far more anti-human rights than the apartheid regime. And this is not because I say so. It's because the United Nations Human Rights Committee finds the practices of the Iranian regime, which increasingly is totally rejected by the Iranian population, and as evidenced by the latest national elections. So I guess none of these is emotional outbursts on my side. I'm just dealing with the facts that United Nations Human Rights Group have declared the practices of Iran as crime against humanity. Behold the comparison with apartheid, crime against humanity. The fact that in Iran today, women are officially, constitutionally seen as half the human being whose rights are violated in every aspect from birth to death.
You got to explain that. Half a human being constitutionally, is that in the law of the country that a woman is?
Absolutely. In the law of the country that women on every ground, not only they cannot wear what they want, they cannot take the job that they want, they cannot travel as they want. They must have a custodian, male custodian, can be a father, can be a husband, and so on and so forth. If there is need for witnesses in the court, if there is one man, then you must have two women in order to comply with the required two. If there are need for four, then you have to have eight women as opposed to four men. It's bizarre, I know. It's middle ages and before. Yet this is a law of the land. Yesterday or 4 days ago, the government doubled down. They passed a law that now if on social media a woman goes and shows her hair, or any kind of dress that may seem to violate their so-called Islamic rules, which is really not Islamic, but let's take it, then the government can automatically use the social media from your picture, map it onto your bank account, and penalize you and take the money. Now, this is really as bad as it's gotten, because the more they become middle age and really uncivilized, the more women reject and the women rebel, and they go and they have seen, as you would have seen the past 10 years, every 4 or 5 years, and there is a uprising against this kind of thought or philosophy or governance. The latest one 3 years ago under the banner of women, life and liberty. This was just the most vivid uprising led by women, acted by women, and supported by men. So I think there are very few countries except Afghanistan, which Taliban runs, who are the same ilk as the mullahs in Iran, who regard women as half men, women who are incapable of making their own decision, and it's men who need to do their thinking, decision, and lifestyle for them. In a way, women are seen, Alec, in that mindset, and I must emphasize, this is not Islamic. This is an interpretation of a particular weird strand of Islam by these mullahs. And they see women as possession. not as a human being. The same way that in the 2,000 or 1,500 years ago in Saudi Arabia, when the women were seen as possession, when a tribe would fight with another tribe and they defeat the other tribe, they kill the men, they capture the women, just they would have captured their goats or camels or gold or whatever. So women are objectified in the sense that they were done in the Saudi Arabian or in the Arabian Peninsula 1,500 years ago. This is absurd. And for the Iranian civilization and the society that has lived 2,000 or more years, way before Islam was born, as a hotbed of civilization, humanity, as the first nation that wrote and registered the Declaration of Human Rights, as a civilization that went from the Persian Empire to the Egyptian Empire to release and free the Jews under the banner of human rights, this is just absolutely not just frustrating, but it goes against every grain of cultural DNA of the Iranian civilization.
It sounds quite, well, otherworldly, but you are Iranian and this is where you come from and you understand it, because the bits that we on the outside know about Iran is that it was Persia, which was the greatest empire on earth for a period of time, highly civilized, has given so much to society. And yet, why do the people put up with it? You can understand in 79 when they threw out the Shah and they believed that the Shah was bad and that you needed something good. But something good going right off the scale to this religious fanaticism that we now see, surely at some point in time, the Iranian people, and there are many of them, and you can tell us a little bit more about the size of the country, would have said, no, we don't like this. Or the perception, of course, that's created outside is, well, they all agree with it.
Alec, that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, Iran, just to sketching the landscape, Iran is 10% geographically, from area point of view, larger than South Africa. So it's a big country, very similar to South Africa. It's got very diverse geographies. It's got a Karoo type of desert or semi-desert. It's got fantastic northern, like the very similar to the Garden Route on the Caspian side. On the west, it's cold and mountainous. It's like a little like Switzerland, the snows and so on. On the east, it's desert and semi-desert, but productive and linguistically, culturally, very different. South Africa's got 10 or 11 tribes, depending how you define it. Iran has got 11 or 12 tribes. These tribes have coalesced over history. But one thing that they have common is their allegiance to the Iranian culture. But they are from north, from the east, from the so-called Arabic genetics or Middle Asia, north Chinese or Indian genetics. One thing that they have over the millennia have developed is their common culture and love of humanity, love of values of humanity, and love of diversity. And Iran has, one of the very few places that I have traveled, and this is not because I favor Iran or I was brought up there, very few places you could go that you could get somebody as dark as people from Tanzania in the south, or as blonde as any German or Norwegian on the northeast. So, and yet they don't see it. Because they have intermingled, they've exchanged families, they've intermarried, and for them, they belong to the same land. So that sense of acceptance, promotion of acceptance, embracing of diversity is a distinctive feature, in my view, of the Iranian evolution of the society of 90 million nowadays, 90. And that is despite the fact that during the First World War, in that era, about a third of the total Persian Empire was taken by the Russia at that time. And the entire Central Asian nations of Azerbaijan, Gürcistan, Turkmenistan, and all of these, both on the northwest and northeast of Iran, were literally physically taken by Russia and brought into the USSR, and subsequently they became independent states as we speak now. So, and yet, even if you go to those countries now, despite the fact that for nearly 100 years they've been so-called separated from Iran and they become independent, but their music, their food, their social culture is 90%, if not more, so-called Iranian or Persian. So that cultural cohesion transcends the sovereign boundaries as have been defined. And that's a very important part of Iran. Now, the question is that you raise, how the hell did they end up with a regime so alien to their culture? And why have they put up with it? Well, that's got a geopolitical context. That goes back literally to the First World War, but more importantly, post-Second World War, where Iran was seen as the bridge for the British to reach Russia to help Russians against Hitler. And Iran had declared itself as neutral. The Shah at that time was focused on developing Iran, was not prepared to become ally of either or, but the Allied forces saw that neutrality as implicit support for Hitler's operations. And therefore, the British said, we're not going to have any of that. They invaded Iran, and they occupied the central piece in order to create a logistical support for the Russian resistance against Hitler. So from Persian Gulf all the way to the Caspian Sea, the British dominated the place, and they helped the Russian battle with the Hitler or Germany. When the war kind of almost finished and Germany was defeated, all Russia, Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill, they got together in Tehran and they said, now what? Now that we have defeated the Germans and we've taken its ally in their mind, banished to Johannesburg, what do we do? The Russians were interested to keep the country, whatever they could, the northern part. And they were refusing to let go. Americans and the British knew the environment, and they thought, that's just not going to be sustainable. So they were looking for a mechanism to persuade the Russians out. And they brought back the Reza Shah's father, the late Shah, who was a young guy, 22 years old. They brought him back as a successor under American-British support. They re-throned him, if you like, to the royalty. And that was then the unifying force to persuade the Russians to leave and respect the territorial boundaries of Iran, which they did. Americans exerted a lot of pressure, and the Shah came back. But the Iranian society, intellectuals, political forces, wanted a different type of configuration. They were constitutionalists. They wanted democratic secularization and modernization. And so there was a battle between the Shah's American supported or British supported, French were also, and Germans, the new German was also in the same camp, call it broadly the West, wanted the Shah to continue. The intellectuals inside, under the leadership of a very distinguished and Swiss educated lawyer, Dr. Mossadegh, he championed the democratization of Iran as opposed to taking it back to a hierarchical royal decree. And the battle between the two continued until 1953, August 1953, where the Americans just didn't want to have any of that. CIA arranged a coup d'etat and basically deposed the anti-Shah group for good. And they firmly stood with the support of the British behind the Shah. So the genesis of what we saw in 1979 dates back to 1948 to 1953. Remember, those were the really the hot days of the Cold War between the emerging USSR and the emerging Western bloc. The market economy, democratic order, as opposed to communist, socialist, central and governance, and so on. So Iran was put in that. And the internal forces, intelligentsia, push and campaigning for modernization and secularization and industrialization was defeated by the CIA-British combination back in 1953. And that then started brewing an underground subterranean religious and communist and nationalist and every other shade and grade, not dissimilar to apartheid. Again, subterranean. We had one common enemy, and that evolved over time. And in 1970s, 1973, 74, 75, the Shah had cancer. And when very few people knew, and even Americans got it wrong, but the French knew and the British knew that the Shah had cancer and his days were well numbered. But the Shah had not made a succession planning in terms of who would succeed him, because his son was too young and almost a teenager and not yet fit for purpose. So the West were fighting USSR. They could not envisage a neutral Iran or a weak Iran. And at that time, I'm now going back to the 1975, 76, 78, the Russians had already invaded Afghanistan and they were defeated by the Taliban, by the religious forces. So Jimmy Carter and Callaghan and Giscard d'Estaing of France, they thought, well, the obvious thing is, if you have a religious fundamentalist ring around this communist USSR, is the best friend of the West. So they put all their weight, politically, military, etc., etc., to replace the Shah with a religious group. And Khomeini was ready to grab it. And Khomeini came in, although all the communist, nationalist, intellectual forces supported it because they had a common enemy called the Shah, who was Western, American puppet, etc., etc. And Khomeini said, I welcome that support. He came in, and within 6 months, and this is a reality in my life, which is dramatic, almost like a Hollywood movie. Khomeini says, okay, now that I'm in power, January 17th, 1980, that's the day that I left Iran, Alec. At 11:15 midnight or at night, 23:15, I took the flight from Tehran to Beijing on my way to Japan before I came to South Africa. At that very night, Khomeini closed the airport at midnight. And between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning, executed all the heads of Communist Party, Nationalist Party, intellectuals, anybody who had any opposition to the religious so-called version of Khomeini's philosophy. So within that night, more than 500 people were literally, and these were national heroes, whether they were communists, intellectuals, nationalists, doesn't matter. These were people who were the top leadership, top political thought leaders of Iran, had their followings, had helped to bring the regime change. And yet, Khomeini literally wiped them out. And since then, since that January 17th, up to today, that process continues. So how did they maintain their hold on the power? By brutal execution, elimination, and zero tolerance, doubling down for now 45 years, up until last week, as I mentioned, their latest against women is another really cog in the same wheel. They have zero tolerance for anything democratic, zero tolerance for anything modern or modern thinking, and zero tolerance for diversity and integration. It's about purification.
Well, that's a story or unpacking that, which we can understand that why the United States is today so angry with Iran. But what about South Africa? We're a constitutional democracy. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Naledi Pandor, appears to have been a very close ally of Iran. It was under her rule that Iran was sponsored into BRICS by South Africa, introduced in there. There's also talk about the ANC's miraculous turnaround from bankruptcy to being able to fight the last election as being quid pro quo for what Iran did at the ICJ, International Court of Justice, attacking Israel. How much of that is true?
And look, I have no evidence. I've also read and listened to all those stories. And those I cannot factually say yes or no. But what I can say is that the extent to which our constitution and the governance thereof by whoever is in charge of governance is counter to so many, if not all, of what the Iranian government, not Iranian people, we must distinguish between the two. And this is an important distinction. As we speak, over 90% by government's own account, over 70%. But by opposition to government, 90% of Iranians don't like, they fight in different ways to get rid of this dominance or invasion of this particular philosophy. So pick and choose between 60% to 90% of the Iranians are opposed to and suffer from and enslaved, literally, by this invasive interpretation of a particular cultural, religious, more law-centric. I would hesitate. In fact, I would vehemently oppose to anybody who says it's an Islamic thing. And I'm not a Muslim, so it's not that I'm being religious. So, but one has to be intellectually very, very honest and factually correct. So in that context, our constitutional values and our social values, as I understand it, 50, 45 years in South Africa, runs contrary to the practices of this regime in Iraq. Now, for Dr. Pandor, who I respect a lot and I've known for 30 years in different forums, was me very surprising. For me, it was extremely surprising that as a woman, distinguished woman, educated woman, a very, very intellectual and well-accomplished woman, she was incredibly, and up to today, very silent about the violation of women's rights, never mind human rights. This is, for me, inexplicable. It just doesn't make sense. That's a fact. And I have no doubt that when she was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, she would send diplomatic notes to Iran to say, look, don't do what you're doing to women. What do I mean by that, Alec? As we speak, the Women Peace Prize Women Award winner is in prison, has been in prison ever since she was granted. There are documented thousands upon thousands of women blinded in the past uprising that I mentioned under the banner of women, life, and liberty. The government said this, and these are teenage girls to mature girls. All of them, don't kill them, blind them. Now we're aimed with bullets at their eyes. And now there are evidence. United Nations is compiling that evidence. It's on their website. So don't trust what I say, check the facts. There's an estimated 50,000 both men and women, intellectuals, artists, media people, philosophers, writers, you name it, in a prison, in Evin prison in Tehran, which is now incidentally called the University of Evin, because South Africa, Iran's really cream de la cream of intellectuals are in prison. South Africa has been silenced on that. Minister Pandu was absolutely silent on it. At the United Nations, every time over the past decade that this question has been tabled at the General Assembly, South Africa has been absent or pro-Iran. Now, these are counter to our constitution. These are sad reflections of poor, in my view, poor decision-making, value judgment. We cannot have the constitution that we have, and our government remains silent in this campaign, institutionalized government that runs on a daily basis, practices that, by UN judgment, is crime against humanity. And of course, there are many, many other elements that we don't have time to go to, but that all is really captured against this judgment that the United Nations Human Rights Commission did, and the investigation that is going on about practices that amounts to institutionalized, run by the government of the land in Iran, which is crime against humanity. This is not just against women, it's against religious minorities. And you mentioned, will they welcome me back there? I'm a member of the Baha'i faith, as I mentioned, and the Baha'is have been on the receiving end of it from day one of this regime, because the Baha'i belief is humanity is one, equality of rights of men and women, respect for cultures, unity in diversity. And these are all principles that is absolutely 180 degrees against what this particular regime in Iran believes. So yes, that is their stance. And as we speak, a number of Baha'is are in prison. Over 250 of them have been executed, and they're not allowed to take a job. They're not allowed to go to school, to the universities. They are not allowed to have their businesses. They are not allowed to be employed by government or by any corporates. So, and this is about the Baha'is, the same they do about the Sunnis who are Muslims. The same to do with other belief system, be they Sufis or be they whatever of their religious or ideological belief. If you are not in that narrow, pure domain, you're an enemy and you need to be suppressed, oppressed, and eliminated.
Sure. There's so much that you've shared with us today that we can understand, but I'd like to get a little bit deeper into the South African relationship with Iran. And in particular, we know, and you know from being in business for so long, being close to the ANC, being in UCT, being the face of Standard Bank in many ways when you were chief economist there, you know that if you want to find the truth, follow the money. And from a South African perspective, if you want to follow the money, there's really only two ways, I guess, that are obvious. The one is clearly that Iran has a lot of oil and it exports oil. Presumably, South Africa may or may not get some of that. I'd love to get your insights. But secondly, MTN owns cell phones. It's the cell phone company of Iran. And there's a lot of controversy around that in the courts, being fought in the courts in the United States about who got paid what for them to get that license. But if you just unpack the two of those, and then give our community an opportunity to think for themselves on where the money actually is flowing and how they themselves can react to it. Let's start with oil.
Look, start at oil and go back to 1970s when Sasol was producing oil from coal. Iran had 17%, 1-7, equity stake in Sasol in those days under the Shah's regime. So the relationship was very deep, and South Africa was the number six highest trading partner of Iran back in 1970s. which was by all the standards quite high. And that was because, as I mentioned, Shah had a very soft spot. And apart from that, the economies of South Africa and Iran at that time, and to some extent today, they are almost perfect trading partners. And I hear, forget about politics, just pure economics. You want to have a trading partners, you need to have something that the other one doesn't have, and you have it, and vice versa. If you can find that, that in economic trade theory is your perfect win-win situation. And Iran in the 1970s had pretty much that. Iran had oil, wanted markets. Iran was after diversification of oil revenue, and Sasol and coal, oil from energy or other sources were perfect diversification. South Africa had lots of wood and agriculture and so on, and Iran desperately was industrializing, needed telecommunication poles, needed technology, needed all kinds of things that South Africa had, and had vice versa. Iran had a lot of mine, gold and copper, but didn't have the technology, didn't have mining companies. South Africa did have that. And I now go back to when I was a research assistant and now producing these reports. These were the facts. So when the revolution happened, the knee-jerk reaction of the government of Khomeini was to cut relationship with South Africa, which was an apartheid country. And of course, very importantly, at that time, there was a triangulation between Israel, Iran, and South Africa. And South Africa had acquired atomic energy. Atomic bomb was very close to building it, and definitely had the technology. So, and Israel had obtained it, and Iran was diversifying its energy sources from oil and carbon footprint to other sources, including atomic energy, nuclear. And South Africa was its partner, Israel was its partner, and Russia was the manufacturer. So the relationship in economic terms goes back to the 1970s. When the revolution happens, and I was a research assistant there, Khomeini wanted to cut this cancerous relationship, and they wanted to cancel, and then only they realized, and I was the one that provided them with information to say, look, hang on, you cannot just close shops so easy. It's not just a few diplomats that you chuck out, but you're talking about 17% of Sasol. You cannot, that's a national asset. So they reversed that very quickly, and the relationship was established. Now, this is 1980, 81. 84, Iran and Iraq entered into a war. They got into a phenomenal battle over the dominance of the region. And South Africa ended up providing weapons to Iraq to fight Iran because it was good for business. Even Reagan, as you would remember, did the same. And Israelis also, look at the irony of it. Israel provided weapons to Iran to fight Iraq. South Africa offered weapons to both of them, but mostly to Iraq. And the philosophy was, well, it's good for business. And that the relationship then went from oil and 17% in Sasol to a much wider range of opportunities. And then Iran, of course, had oil. But apart from 17% sharing in Sasol, the Shah at that time, through the Iranian National Oil Company, had invested in a storage facilities in Saldanha Bay for strategic reserves of South Africa, which still operates as we speak. And the plan was that Iran would use those for two purposes. When times are exceptional, it would become the national reserves of South Africa. If a war breaks down or any emergencies, if not, then it would be a warehousing for Iranian oil distribution globally. And given that Iran was investing in Sasol, there was no conflict of interest. So that's the genesis of the relationship of economic. But then the wars between Iraq and Iran broadened that from oil and energy into a more strategic relationship. The question was not South Africa had to choose between Iraq and Iran. Who do you support? And when the Khomeini regime became dominant and when the Iraq was battled by the Americans, deposed, then really Iraq was no longer a place to do business. There was not much opportunities for trade with South Africa. South Africa then focused on Iran, which made sense. And that relationship has gone from a narrow trade to a wider trade. Of course, Iran being under sanction, international financial sanction, you cannot do direct trade. You do it through Dubai, which most countries do. Then MTN came about. MTN was a big opportunity because it was modernizing communication in Iran. But Alex, remember, as we speak, 90% of the Iranian economy is controlled by this invading religious group. So it's not as if MTN could get into a private sector partnership. You partnering with this dominant group, and they had to choose their partner, and in effect, they are partnering with government. They are partnering, in fact, in this case, they are partnering with the military wing of the regime in Iran, not with the commercial. Again, it's important to note that 90% of the Iranian economy, be it infrastructure, be it import, be it export, be it minerals, be it oil, be it anything that is medium to large, is controlled by the regime directly or indirectly. So MTN ended up a partner with the Iranian regime. And therefore, there are two elements to this. One is the how did they get it? Who got what bribe and so on? The Turkish telecommunication, Turkcell was also a bidder, but MTN won. But there's absolutely no doubt that they paid. They couldn't have got it if they didn't. That's just as simple as that. Secondly, but more important, from a human point of view, from a social welfare and human rights point of view, during all the oppressive bouts, I mentioned every 4 or 5 years, there is an uprising in Iran against the regime. In some or other form, the latest one 3 years ago under the banner of women, life and liberty. And I'll come back to this importance of women as a pillar of this regime. But be as it may, every time that a social uprising happens, which is bloody and anything between 5,000 to 50,000 people get killed every time. How many people get made blinded and so on, that's a separate story. But it's not a Mickey Mouse uprising. It's a titanic existential battle for values of liberty and cohesion or middle-aged type of values of purification on religious values ground. Or not just religious, a particular sect of religion. So MTN, by partnering in Iran with government, has been the platform for oppression, for tracking people, for anything that a service provides. So the Iranian nation is not the regime. The 90% or the 70% who are opposing it have no doubt that MTN, like a couple of other corporates, have been implicit and complicit with this oppression that goes on. And that's the unfortunate part. That's very unfortunate for MTN and for its strategic decision making. And then make it worse, and I don't want to divert from where you are interested in, MTN is the same partner because of their partnership in Iran. They are also controlling the telephonic network in Syria because of the link between Iran and Syria, or Iranian regime and Syrian regime. So even then, more so, that if you recall in the Syrian wars and battles that started in 2014 or so, up until today, for the past 10 years, 12 million Syrians, reportedly by the United Nations and human rights organizations, have been displaced, scattered around the globe as refugees. Over something between, again, I don't know which of these figures you believe, but these are the brackets in the different organization, between 350,000 and 600,000 people have been killed. Now, just compare that with what's happening in Gaza. To just give you a benchmark, when we take value position as Dr. Pander did, because of the inhumanities happening in Gaza, which needed to be mentioned, but when 500,000 Syrians are wiped out by the Iranian regime, is not seen as a genocide, and is not, in fact, South Africa is not pronounced on it at all. So you have these contradictions that are enabled by either naive support for this regime or financially driven or politically driven interests, I don't know. But the irony of it is just as stark as day and night. And MTN is one of the symbols of oppression, enabling suppression in the society, in Iran and in Syria.
Raj Abedian, it has been a true privilege to get your insights into the country where you grew up and grew and, well, gratefully came to ours. Dr. Abedian is the founder of Pan-African Capital. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.